I mean, I'm a big believer. So if we look at China right now, I mean, I'm a big believer in being greedy when people are fearful and fearful when people are greedy.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. In 1996, two men called Don St. Pierre, father and son, changed the world of wine forever by founding ASC Fine Wines in Shanghai. Don St. Pierre Sr. had seen an opportunity, as he later wrote about China's 1.2 billion population. All of these folks had to drink and eat something. Before long, they were distributing Beringer and Bollinger, and they pretty much single-handedly established China's fine wine market. Don St. Pierre Jr. retired from the business in 2015 and shortly after became CEO and co-owner of California's Vinfolio. Don St. Pierre Sr. died in 2023. Recently, Don St. Pierre Jr. founded Adaptage, an investment and advisory company, and he remains bullish on China, even though wine consumption there peaked in 2017. In this interview, he explains why he believes so strongly in China and why he's so optimistic about wine in general. As always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you can sign up for at drinksinsider.com. Don, great to see you.
Thank you, Felicity.
Okay, you have a long and distinguished career in wine, and now you're in a brand new chapter. So tell me about AdaptEdge, why you founded it, what is it, how is it different from other strategic advisory and investment firms, and just tell me all about it.
Well, I think I reached a stage in my life where I decided the best path forward was really to share my experiences and look to invest in opportunities and people that I believe in, rather than as an entrepreneur, build it or do it myself. So I've spent the last, I guess, 35 years now, building companies, myself or largely myself. At 56 years old, closing in on 57, I feel like it's an important, time in my life to change paths and focus on how I can share my experiences to help others and how we can invest in exciting entrepreneurs, exciting ideas, exciting businesses. So, that's the reason behind the shift towards AdaptEdge. And AdaptEdge is a advisory and investment business. We're focused on working with families. And at the moment, in the wine industry, I think lifestyle as a category is interesting for the future in terms of expansion. But in the beginning, we're really going to focus on two areas. One, we'll be working with families in the wine industry, businesses that are run or controlled by families, and the second will be to invest in opportunities, both with our own money and with outside capital that is aligned with our vision and where we think both ourselves and the outside capital can really add real value to the businesses we're looking at investing.
Okay, let's take both of those topics. Why family businesses? What's the appeal?
I just love them. I love multi-generational family businesses. It's really the source of my passion for the wine industry. So if I look back on my journey in the wine industry, when we started ASC with my dad in 1996, so much of our connection and success and interest is tied to these families behind the wines. And if I really look back on the things that excite me most, it's about the relationships that I've built with these families and the stories that they represent, and the multiple generations that many of them have in the pursuit of building their businesses. So, that's the basis.
So over the course of reporting on wine, which is more than 20 years now, you know, the wine people tend to revere family businesses. But many family businesses I reported on are extremely dysfunctional. They reproduce the family dysfunction through the whole company. And obviously some don't. Some, you know, survive for hundreds and hundreds of years. So when you evaluate family companies, what's the difference between sort of the, shall I say, the neurotic ones and the ones that you would be keen to invest in?
Yeah, so I think we're looking at investing in businesses that are run by exceptional individuals or people and have a strong foundation that we feel we can add value to by adapting to how things will change in the future. So our investment strategy is not necessarily tied to multi-generational family businesses that are in the wine business, right? We are looking at investing in businesses that we feel the wine industry will benefit from.
Right.
Now, in terms of who we want to invest with, you know, ideally, I think we want to invest with families from the wine industry that have an interest in the idea, right? Together with us. So we have to separate the two. One is we're looking at investing in businesses that we think we can add a lot of value to, that we think can transform and adapt, change to the future direction of opportunities. And then the second is, who do we want to work with? Well, on those investments, we want to work with families that I have relationships with, that I respect, that are possibly less dysfunctional than many of the families that you spoke about, because I do appreciate and I understand the dysfunction. I will say, you know, that's not specific to the wine industry, right?
Oh, no.
Family businesses in general have, you know, so many examples of dysfunction. I think what's unusual about the wine industry is how many successful ones there are. Relative to other industries. I think if you look at an industry, there is no greater example of multi-generational success than wine. If you look at a country, it's probably Japan in terms of the number of successful multi-generational family businesses. But in terms of an industry, I think wine is the leader, despite what you say is true, which is there are a lot of dysfunctional families.
I'm just always in awe of it because, you know, as much as I appreciate my own family, I can't imagine going into business with them. We would be on the pile of failures within, you know, a year. So I'm always interested in people who can work with their family and, you know, the relationships are so intense in your family, and then to sort of move it into a business relationship as well is really difficult. So just say I've got a family business and maybe I'm in something interesting, like, I don't know, digital innovation, and you're assessing me to invest in me and you decide to invest in me. How does it work? Is this a loan that I will pay back, or do you own part of the company, or how does the investment operate?
No, we would ideally like to take an equity position in the business. Really from there, it depends on what the entrepreneur wants to do in the future. You know, do they see themselves running this business and controlling this business in the next 10 years? Or are they a family? Are they an entrepreneur that's been at it for 20 years already and they really would like to think about an exit? You know, I've been on the other side of this in a number of situations where I've brought investors in initially as a minority or as a majority. So I think I'm in a relatively good position to understand both sides. Yeah, but we're not looking to make loans, Felicity. We're looking to make equity investments in the business.
And speaking of money, you said some of it comes from you and some of it comes from other investors. Who are the other investors and why would they be interested in investing in this industry?
Well, it's really going to be opportunity specific. So we're not going to be creating a traditional fund. We're going to be creating opportunities to invest in specific businesses. And based on that opportunity, we'll then go out and source capital that is aligned around the opportunity, i.e., can this additional capital not only provide, you know, money, but can they add value with us to helping the business advance, improve, and take advantage of the future opportunities? So, in terms of who we're going to be working with, you know, I think we're probably looking at 10 to 15 different families, that would likely have an interest, but then it'll be specific to different opportunities. So, you know, we made an investment with Natalie and VinoJoy. That was really capital that came specifically from our family. And I think our future investments with Natalie will continue to be through our family office.
I really want to talk about this because I think everybody who's in the wine media cheered when you did this. You know, it's fantastic to see because that started as a newsletter and now it's a very serious platform. But there's not a lot of investment at the moment going around into media or new media. What made that attractive and how big do you think it can get?
I think first it was the person. So the more I got to know Natalie, the more I was impressed with her intelligence, her integrity, her work ethic, her understanding. So I think first it starts with the person. I think second, it's about data and mm-hmm. it's about lack of access to data and information that the business of wine needs to better understand opportunities in China. Right. So if I go back to my experience in China in building ASC, part of our success was being transparent with our suppliers, our producers, about what was happening in the market. And through that, we built trust and long-term relationships. So we were trying to provide data about what was happening in the market, not necessarily just about ASC, but about the market. And there was so little of it. And so when I look at what Natalie's done as an entrepreneur to start this business, as you say, coming from a newsletter to building something that really was already providing a lot of interesting intelligence and important data to consumers outside of China. So I thought, wow, that's really needed. And how can I help Natalie expand this platform? Because access to data, not only about wine, but about anything in China, is so limited. So that was really the foundation for why we saw the investment being appealing. How do we help brand owners, producers better understand the market so then they can make decisions which are more aligned with what their future strategy is and what their values are?
I mean, it's a fantastic publication. Everybody quotes it. It's an absolute must read. But like I said, you know, media is not something that many people are investing in at the moment. So what particularly was the opportunity you were looking at? I asked this as a newsletter writer. What was it that grabbed you about that business?
It really came down to the fact that in a market like China, there's very little information that's available, right? So, I mean, frankly, if there was 10 different publications that were all providing accurate, reliable data on the market, I don't think the opportunity from our perspective would have been that interesting, right? So I think, Natalie really is a pioneer in building out this platform that's specific to China, although she's got great intelligence in other markets around Asia. But I think China is the market that has the least amount of transparency and the greatest need to improve that for brand owners that want to invest and build their brand in China.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, you know, as you know, as editor of a business magazine for a long time, and the problem with China is that you end up with expats writing for you, and if they don't have the language, they just go and talk to other expats, and so you never really get inside the market at all. All right, so that's VinoJoy, and I noticed that the areas that you're thinking about investing in include market intelligence, brand communication, digital innovation. Is that because you believe that in general these are good investments or because you believe there's a critical shortage of them in the wine sector?
Both.
Both, okay.
Yeah, I think, if we look at where the wine industry is today and the challenges that it faces, I think part of the challenges are rooted in difficulty in communicating their stories to the consumers and the bottlenecks that exist throughout the world in different markets to do that, and the fragmentation that represents the industry. So I think digital innovation will allow for platforms to develop, and they already are, to allow brand owners to tell their stories directly to consumers and dramatically improve the consumer's understanding and interest of the products. So I think it's important from that perspective.
I mean, you know, you hear this a lot about, you know, people need to tell their stories and so on. What is in particular is missing? Like, if you could wave your magic wand, as opposed to the long-term investing right now, if you could change something or add something to the world of wine, what would it be?
That's a great question. I don't know. I have the answer to that. I would say, you know, each market is different. And I'm looking specifically at China right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I see where platforms like Xiaohongshu, Little Red Book, or Douyin, which is TikTok, or Bilibili, these are platforms that are allowing small to medium-sized to large producers of products to communicate their stories to the end consumer. And then for the end consumer to actually acquire the products simultaneously with hearing about the stories, right? So I think that's very exciting. Now, there's a lot of problems with how things are being done on these platforms, particularly for premium brands. And the storytellers that had previously been successful are increasingly running into problems related to how authentic the consumers feel they are in telling these stories. But saying that, these are really unique platforms that allow the consumer to both understand, engage, and acquire the product that the story is being told about, right? That's really unique to China, I believe. So then it comes down to how are the stories being told? And are they told in a relevant way? For example, I think that the brand owners oftentimes are best positioned to tell their own stories. But, you know, each market, the consumer wants to hear a story about something that's relevant to them that may not be relevant to a consumer in Germany, say. So the stories have to be adapted in a way where the local consumers find them interesting. But the platforms are there. And I think that's a very exciting, that's a reason to be optimistic about the future of wine.
So the TikTok is now allowing alcohol in North America. And I've just written a story about it because TikTok completely changed the world of book publishing. You know, book publishing started growing by 21% a year. And to your point about authenticity, it wasn't because of slick Instagram images. It was because of teenage girls in their bedroom saying, I loved this book and talking about it. And it just transformed the fortunes of the publishing industry. Do you think it's got that possibility of transforming wine as well?
Well, you know, I think the regulatory environment in the United States and the three-tier system creates additional challenges.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm makes me excited about China is that there isn't as much regulation around how alcohol is distributed. And I think there's less challenges associated with this movement against wine and alcohol for reasons of health. But that's a different topic. But I feel like this environment in China can be a North Star of sorts to show the rest of the world how it can be done successfully. So I think that's interesting, particularly in the context of how difficult the environment is in China today for wine producers to sell their wines.
Yeah, let's talk about China. I was going to leave it to later, but let's get on to it. I mean, given your extensive experience there, how do you read the current market? Because from the outside, it looks like it's a downturn, or maybe the Chinese are returning to their historic patterns of consumption that, you know, they've got a cuisine that's existed for 4,000 years and they didn't really need wine for most of that. Is this them returning to the historic norm, or is there something else going on in the market, like politics and governance, that's leading to a temporary flattening of the market? How do you read it?
I think it's temporary, but I think we have to step back and understand what are the primary drivers of why exports of wine to China have declined as much as they have, and why consumption has declined as much as it has. I think there's first a political impact of the government cracking down on conspicuous consumption. Government-related entertainment is way, way down. So this has had a major impact on wine consumption, because going back to the problem of data, we don't really know, you know, what percentage of imported wine was related to government entertaining government consumption, but it was significant. And so that's largely gone away. Now, what happens to that in the future? I don't know. I would suspect that it will eventually make its way back, you know, in maybe in a different form. But, you know, I can't imagine a world in China where, you know, government officials are banned from drinking alcohol the way they are today, lasting over the next 20 years. So that's one element. The second element is related to how consumers feel about the future. And right now, they're not feeling very good about the future. They're feeling confused, and they lack confidence. And so what that has done is caused them to save a lot more and spend a lot less. So savings rates in China have skyrocketed, and consumption of products like wine have declined dramatically, because people, you know, are thinking, well, rather than spend my money on this bottle of wine, which I really don't need, I think I'm going to save it. Or I'm going to spend money on something else that I do need. So these two factors have collided. And then you put that, you overlay that with what happened with COVID, and how China really came out of COVID much later than the rest of the world. Now, you know, China was in a place where the rest of the world wasn't, in terms of having normalcy during COVID. People were out entertaining, they were drinking, they were having fun during COVID when the rest of the world was locked down. But then things changed, and it became much more challenging, much more difficult. So when we look at where China is coming out of COVID, it's later, right? Mm-hmm. So I think those three factors combine together to create a real, real difficult macro environment for selling a product like wine.
The other thing, of course, is the real estate market in China. You know, the Wall Street Journal is saying maybe China is going to be like Japan, where it went into stagnation for quite a long time. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I think the real estate problem is significant, and that's one of the factors behind people lacking confidence in the future, right? So there are many economic reasons why, and political economic reasons why, people are not as confident in tomorrow as they are today. And that was really a key factor behind the Chinese government's success, is that people looked at tomorrow and they thought, it's going to be better than today, so I can feel confident to go out and spend money, right? And today they're thinking, well, I don't think it's going to be better than today. And so why? Well, real estate's one of the reasons, because the value of that apartment that they own, which may represent, you know, 50, 60% of their net worth, has declined. And that had never happened before.
So when the Chinese do drink, what do they drink?
Well, you know, that's changing now. So when you pull out the government consumption, that removes a lot of consumption that was related to giving people face. Showing respect, and how you do that is by buying a bottle of a wine that's known around the amongst the circles of Chinese government. So there's a relatively few number of wines that were known, and Bordeaux made up a big part of that, high-end Bordeaux. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why it's suffering right now. So what are they drinking now? I think that's one of the reasons to be optimistic, is that we're seeing consumers start to drink what they're interested in, as opposed to what they think they should drink, right? And what they think they should buy in order to close this business deal or in order to give face to someone else. So I think we're starting to see a shift in consumers' interest towards taste profiles that they really enjoy. And, you know, what are those? China's a big place. It's like Europe. So, you know, when you overlay China and when you look at China province by province, it's not too ridiculous to say it's not too far different than, say, Italy versus Germany versus France versus Switzerland versus Spain versus Portugal. So each region has different preferences and interests based upon their cuisines and their cultures. But, you know, one thing that seems to be happening is white wine is gaining traction.
Interesting. So I'll get onto data and stuff in a second, but you have seen everything in China. You were there right at the beginning. So how is what you're seeing now different to what you saw at the beginning? Give me a potted summary of the trajectory of the Chinese market in the last 30 years, 28 years.
Yeah, well, when we started in 1996, you know, there was really very little wine consumption. It was all about foreigners going into international hotels drinking wine, or it was about government banquets drinking some of the local wines that were available, and that was pretty much it. And then we had this, you know, rapid increase in interest in wine due to reasons of health. Let's entertain with wine instead of Baijiu, but I don't want to overplay that because, you know, Baijiu is still, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room as it relates to alcohol consumption in China. I think Moutai and Wulang Ye, the two biggest brands, are both significantly larger market cap than Diageo. So when they talk about which are the largest alcohol companies in the world, you know, people usually say, well, Diageo, Pernod Ricard, Suntory Beam,
Heineken,
and they forget that the first two are Moutai and Wulang Ye. So, you know, we have to put into context the fact that there was this quote unquote boom in interest in wine. But when you step back and you look at, well, what did wine represent at its peak in terms of value vis-a-vis Baijiu, it was still very, very tiny. But nonetheless, what we saw was a big expansion of where wine was sold and who was drinking wine. And government was involved, business entertainment was involved, Chinese restaurants boomed, and with that, wine lists started to develop. So, you know, supermarkets like Carrefour and Metro and so many others developed and had big wine sections. So, you know, all of that happened from 1996 to 2000. Let's say when we sold our business was 2010 initially, and then I kept some shares and exited eventually in 2014. And, you know, I think at one point we were seeing 45% year-on-year growth. So dramatic increases in demand. And then, you know, and then I left for 9 years, Felicity. So when you say that I know a lot about China and I've experienced a lot, yes and no. So, you know, I've been gone the last 8 years. I'm very cognizant of that. I am very much in the mode of learning about where China is today. I think I have a bit of an advantage because so many of the people that used to work for us are scattered throughout the industry. And I'm still close to many of them. So I have the opportunity to gain insights and intelligence from a lot of really smart people that are very connected to the wine industry and the alcohol industry. So where we're at today versus where we were, we're certainly dramatically improved from where it was in 1996. Mm. But if you look at where things were, say, in 2010, 2011, well, government consumption has gone away, not completely, but mostly, and consumers are very cautious about the future. And those two factors have made a big negative impact.
Where does domestic production sit in this? What happened to all those wineries in Ningxia? I mean, I know the top ones, the Silver Heights and so on, are still there, but there was a lot of planting at one stage. Has that stopped or are they still going?
Yeah, well, I was there a couple weeks ago, and you know, I was visiting a couple different wineries, and I was, you know, I'd been there a long time, and I was super impressed with the development. It's got to be one of the most difficult places in the world to grow wine. You know, on the one side, 200 millimeters of rainfall a year. As far as I know, there's only one region in the world that deals with such a small amount of rainfall. It's Argentina, Mendoza. And then on top of that, they have temperatures that require them to bury the vines during the winter. So, you know, China picked a challenging place to be their, you know, to be their focus for the wine industry. But the investment that's occurred and is continuing is really impressive. And the quality of the wine that they're making is improving, I think, in a very important way.
Let's turn to your company, Adaptage. So you're relying on data. Where does your market intelligence come from?
From people. I mean, I think that's where you have to get market intelligence. I mean, obviously, access to data from the various agencies that are in charge of keeping track of imports in China, the different ports, is important. But, you know, these reports are more restricted than what they used to be.
Really? Why is that?
Yeah. Couple different reasons. It's complicated. I think the reports were not used correctly by certain players, so the decision was made to shut down access to a lot of these reports.
That's a cryptic comment. But how do you misuse? What do you mean misusing? Were people doing insider trading, or what was happening? Or maybe we don't talk about that.
Yeah, I'm not really sure of the details, but I do know that access to data that had been available pre-COVID isn't as available as what it once was. So for me, it comes down to people that are on the ground that understand what's happening from a consumer perspective, from a wholesaler perspective, from a retail perspective, from a restaurant perspective. I mean, we have to have strong relationships with people that are connected to all of these different channels in different provinces and different regions. And that's where data comes from. And then you triangulate and you try to understand, well, if this is happening in this province, or this is happening in that province, or this is happening in this channel, what does it all mean?
So talk me through how that actually works. Do you have an office full of people who are always on the phone going, Ted, what's happening in your city? Or is it that you're always going out to dinner and going, so Ted, what's happening? Or are you, like, how do you actually do this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, one of the reasons we made an investment in Vinojoy is providing us insights into what's happening around China. You know, for wine-related business. So, you know, I think what Natalie and her team is doing, and it's a team that's expanding quite a lot, is very important to our ability to understand what's happening in the market. Then we're hiring a local team that I think represent the best of what you could hope to find in terms of intelligence around the wine industry in China. As I said earlier, I'm very fortunate to have sort of an alumni network of best-in-class people that used to work with us at ASC. And so we'll continue to hire more people as we see a need. And through the combination of those things, the relationships that I have, you know, we build out channels to understand what's happening in different markets and different regions in China.
Before I leave this topic and move on to other topics, how much are you going to stick to China? I mean, there are other markets which are becoming extremely interesting, like Vietnam and South Korea. Are you going to be simply China, mainland China, or are you going to move into other parts of Southeast Asia?
No, I don't see us. Well, first of all, the answer is yes, but I don't see us expanding the idea of helping wineries better understand what's happening in the market and empowering them to make better decisions, I think, beyond China. So I see that specific area is very much of a China focused project for us, projects. But in terms of other opportunities that we'd be looking at, you know, for example, I still have ownership in Vinfolio Fine and Rare. So this is a marketplace for fine wine consumers and fine wine producers. And this is a global marketplace. And I'm very excited to continue to be involved at the board level and as a shareholder of this business. And, you know, if I look at the big picture of what we're interested in doing, we're interested in empowering brand owners to make better decisions and to take more control over their marketing and sales in the markets that they can do that in.
Okay, you know? let's give a practical example. Let's just say I am a fine wine brand owner. How does it work? How do I use Vinfolio? Talk me through. So if I'm a producer of a well-known wine, say an Ornellaia or something like that, how do I work with the platform?
Well, it depends on the market, right? So in the United States, we would most likely be working with the Ornellaia importer and make offers that are coming from that importer or their wholesaler specific to our customers. We would be doing events around Ornellaia, and we would seek to understand where the customer's interest is in the product, and how do we pair that with what's available in the market from Ornellaia and other sources. So, you know, as a platform to allow engagement between the producer and the consumer, Vinfolio Fine and Rare is trying to create an environment where we're sharing information about the customer feels they have more direct access to the producer, and the producer has more line of sight and understanding of what's happening at the customer level, right? And so we have, if you look at the structure of Vinfolio or Fine and Rare, the license structure that we have enables that type of interaction to happen.
Yeah, I mean, this is a key problem for many fine wine producers, is that they have no understanding of who their final consumer is.
Right.
Yeah, so is that a problem that you're solving?
Well, I mean, I think in the United States, as I mentioned earlier, there's regulatory challenges associated with allowing fully transparent, direct communication between the brand owner and the consumer. Right. So going back to my point earlier, it depends on the market. If we look at China, on the other hand, there's nothing that would prevent an Ornellaia from establishing their own import business and selling directly to end consumers. So that's quite interesting.
So why, speaking as Ornellaia, if I can do that in China, why would I use your platform?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at what Ornellaia's resources are and where they want to focus their attention, my feeling is they likely do not want to set up their own import company with staff by their own people to deal with China customs, to deal with hygiene sanitation, to deal with back labels, all those things.
So
right?
You can take care of all of that. Okay, so, all right, as you know, I'm not really Ornellaia. I'm a small brand that I think I'm fantastic. Can I come and be listed with you? What do I have to do to jump through your hoops?
Well, we have to step back first because we were talking about Vinfolio and Fine and Rare. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, Vinfolio and Fine and Rare do not have operations inside of mainland China.
Right.
Their offices are based in Hong Kong, they're based in Singapore, they're based in Napa, they're based in London, they're based in Milan. So these are areas where we are building out a platform that will enable that type of transaction and that type of relationship to occur more and more in the future. Now, in terms of mainland China, then we look at what AdaptEdge wants to do. You know, we're looking at making investments, Felicity, in platforms, businesses that would enable producers to engage more directly in the market. Right. So that's for the future. These are, right. these are opportunities that I think are very exciting, because I think the way the brand owner goes to market in China is changing quite quickly. And so we want to be making investments in platforms that can enable that brand owner to be closer to the consumer and take more control over their own destiny in China.
All right, let's talk about the Harvard Data Science Initiative that you're part of. Can you talk about that? What is it and what do you do there?
So the Harvard Data Science Initiative, and what we did, we organized a symposium in June of this year, where it was a partnership between the Harvard Data Science Review, the Journal of Wine Economics, and wineries that were invited to participate. So the wine industry, the Journal of Wine Economics, the Harvard Data Science Review. So we brought the three together for a day of discussions, collaboration around the idea of how data can be used to help the wine industry deal with challenges that it's facing. And we had two buckets of areas of focus. One was climate change, and the other was how AI can be paired with data to help brand owners better understand the consumer and better market and sell their wines to the consumer. So those were the two buckets. So it was a first attempt at leveraging Harvard's expertise and the Harvard Data Science expertise around data, around data science, combined with the economists that make up the Journal of Wine Economics and the wine industry.
And did you come up with any conclusions?
I think there were some really interesting takeaways, and we're still building out the understanding through surveys from all the participants of what were the most important takeaways from their perspective. But I think the need for stronger collaboration between the research side of academics and the industry was very apparent. And the opportunity to collaborate between the two and the willingness to collaborate was very present. So I think that was one big takeaway. You know, we have some really exciting things that are being researched in the world of academics that the industry really didn't know about.
This is a really interesting point. I mean, in Europe, there is such I won't say firewall, I'll say a ditch. It's like a moat between there's a lot of fantastic science going on and it just never gets communicated to the industry. Whereas in Australia with the Australian Wine Research Institute, there was a lot of fantastic science that they did communicate to the industry, but of course they've cut that. Do you think the wine industry needs new institutions, or who should be responsible for translating research into something that the industry needs to know about? Is that a journalist's responsibility, or do we need another institution?
I don't think we need to build new institutions. I think that there needs to be a greater willingness to pick up the phone, send an email, contact researchers. So I said first starts with understanding who's doing what, right? And then based on that, the folks on the industry side seeing, okay, this is super interesting. Let me contact this person and see how we can collaborate. So I don't know that needs a specific new institution to do. I just feel like there needs to be a willingness amongst the industry to reach across the aisle and say, hey, can you help us figure this out based on your research that you've done or you're thinking about doing? Right? And I think on the flip side, the researchers, academia, will be very interested in doing that because, you know, they need funding to help further research. And I think the industry has that available.
Yeah, sometimes it's very frustrating. Sometimes in conversation, people have dropped research that's going on, and I'm like, "What? Why don't you tell me about it? You know, when the paper is published, send me the paper." And they never do. There's a clear need to translate research into language that people can understand. But it's very frustrating. I think researchers particularly have so much to do; they do it and then publish it in their own journals.
Yeah, I think if you go back to the Harvard Data Science Review, and the person, the editor-in-chief of of that, Charlie Meng, who's an old friend of mine, you know, he has a real strong passion for wine. And he sees wine as it relates to the industry of wine, as it relates to something that what the Harvard Data Science Review is doing, each other can really benefit. So I think in terms of platforms, I think Harvard Data Science Review can be one that can organize researchers around the world, and to create a link between the industry. And that's really was the at the heart of what we wanted to do with this initiative, with this symposium. And I think, you know, based on what we saw in June, it was a success. The other thing I would say that supports that is there were a number of young researchers that work in the Harvard Data Science Initiative, which is the umbrella organization under which the Harvard Data Science Review sits. And, you know, the Harvard Data Science Review, if you think about the Harvard Business Review for business, this is what the Harvard Data Science Review is doing for data, right? So a lot of these young researchers, when they sat through the symposium, they thought, wow, this is an industry that I really want to help. I want to work in. So that was also super encouraging because a lot of these young researchers, data scientists, no longer want to go work in the tech field for various reasons. That was something that was expressed to me. And I thought, wow, that's really encouraging. Not that they don't want to work in the tech world, but they're interested in working in the world of wine because they see a very fragmented industry with a lot of data where they can make a very positive impact on the industry.
So for anybody listening, Don obviously has invested in Natalie and Vino Joy, but if you've got research, send it to me and I will put it in my newsletter. Okay, so you're also entrepreneur in residence at the Harvard Innovation Labs. Do you want to talk about that and what's going on at Harvard? What sort of innovations and developments are people excited about?
Well, so this, the Harvard Innovation Lab is something that was established quite a few years ago. And I was nominated by the Dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Science, which back then was Charlie Meng, as an entrepreneur to provide, you know, insights and experiences to young entrepreneurs at Harvard that had different ideas. And so the way it works is, from any school at Harvard, you can approach the iLab, the Innovation Lab, and say, hey, I've got this idea. They allow you to come in and work on their idea, at the lab and use the resources of the lab. And then if you pass certain tests, then you can make it to a next round and eventually try and seek funding for your idea through the network that Harvard has. And so as someone that's involved in the program, I would each year have an opportunity to sit down with certain entrepreneurs at Harvard based on my experience and just try to help them think through their ideas. So that was the reason for it. And again, it all started with my friendship of Dean Meng, who then transitioned and went on from being the Dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Science to the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Data Science Review.
And with all of that exposure that you've had to entrepreneurship, is there anything that you've seen through that you think the wine industry should emulate or use in some way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because I think the wine industry, from an agricultural standpoint, is really good at thinking about innovation and embracing uncertainty. You know, they have to be, because Mother Nature doesn't cooperate most of the time. So as a business, I think they're good at dealing with the uncertainty that surrounds viticulture. And they're good at understanding how technology can help them better deal with it in the future. Now, that's not to say that there's better ways for them to cooperate with researchers, as we say. I think there are. But if you look at the business side, I don't think they're very good. I don't think they embrace uncertainty. They embrace innovation as much as what they should. They're much more traditional in their approach. So I think that's a very important opportunity in the future, is to help wineries transition from a traditional mindset as it relates to how they approach business to more of an innovative mindset, and one where they really embrace the uncertainty of what technology and innovation means for the future.
What kind of innovations would you be talking about? For example, I mean, you know, wine is made the way wine has been made since the year dot. Are you talking about marketing innovations? Are you talking about new products? Are you talking about new hybrid products? What does innovation mean to you in this context?
Yeah, I think all of that, but then how do you communicate and engage with the consumers in a more effective way?
Mm. Right?
And so how do you leverage technology to do that? How do you use data in a way where you understand the consumer better and make their experience more interesting? So, for example, if we think of Napa Valley, Napa Valley is in a unique position, kind of the envy of the world as it relates to being able to connect with the end consumers directly and sell wine directly. But a lot of producers are struggling to understand how to use the data they have on the consumers to get better engagement. And the consumers are changing a lot from the way they used to be. So, you know, even in a place where the wines, the brand owners have the data directly about the consumers and the consumers are purchasing the wine directly, they're still really unsure how to use that data in a meaningful way to engage the consumer. So to me, that's an opportunity to improve on better use of data. And there are many different experts out there that can help them do that. So it comes down to how do they allocate resources towards getting better and embracing the uncertainty of this, using technology and new ways to take the data they have and make it meaningful to engage the consumer.
All right, so we're coming to the end of this very interesting conversation. You've said publicly that you're very optimistic about the future of wine. Now, a lot of other people are not very optimistic about the future of the wine. We're seeing threats from the health lobby. We're seeing declining consumption that looks like it's systemic, not just cyclical. Why are you optimistic, and where do you think the opportunities are?
So I think the basis for my optimism is the nature of wine, in the sense of it being craft, artisan, original, authentic. And I think 20 years from now, consumers will want that more than they do today.
Interesting. Well, that's a very interesting thought. Can you expand on that?
I think technology and AI is going to make life so automated and make decisions for us in so many things, which I think can be very positive. But I also think what is really authentic and real becomes more scarce. Mm. And so the products that fit into these categories, authentically fit into these categories, will become more rare. And I think the wine industry sits in a unique space. And I think for that reason, the product is going to be in greater demand 20 years from now than it is today. Now, what they're going to have to do is figure out how to communicate their stories more effectively than what they're doing today. And I'm optimistic that they will figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I was reading yesterday. Some tech overlord came out and said, the price of white collar work is going to turn into pennies, whether it's legal advice or even medical advice. And I was thinking to myself, you know, for all these years I've reported on the wine business, and you know, everybody's been saying they should be more business like and they should be this. They may be the last people left standing because they're still working with something that's tangible and real, and
right.
it can't be you know, magicked away with AI. So you've left on a very positive note. Well, where do you think the opportunity is right now?
Well, let me say though that I think the biggest threat is related to the move to reduce open trade around the world and reduce specialization. So I feel that's the thing I'm most concerned about, is the closing of borders and losing the benefits to allow specialization to occur in different economies and different parts of the world. Because when specialization occurs, innovation occurs, and innovation consistently solves problems in the world that people don't think can be solved. So I feel optimistic in the sense that innovation is going to solve a lot of the problems, whether that's climate change or, you know, whether that's figuring out how to tell the story of an artisan producer, craft producer to an end consumer. But there are real threats out there, and that's that threat of, you know, closing down our borders and not having open trade is a big one. Sorry, your question for listening.
Leave it on an optimistic note, not the apocalyptic one. Where do you see the opportunity or the optimism now rather than in 20 years?
I'm a big believer. So if we look at China right now, I mean, I'm a big believer in being greedy when people are fearful and fearful when people are greedy. So there's a lot of fear around China, and I feel like that's an important reason to jump in and be optimistic and be rationally optimistic about the future. Because, you know, if we look at China, you know, it's the second largest economy in the world by a very, very long way versus in India or versus in Germany or where Japan was. So I have a very hard time believing that in 20 years from now, people will be drinking a lot less wine than they are today. I happen to believe that people are going to be drinking a lot more wine in China than they are today. And so the challenges that the industry is going through at the moment provide an enormous opportunity to help think through what the new models are and be part of those new models in the future. So, you know, when my dad and I started ASC in 1996, no one was really that involved in wine, and we helped build out an infrastructure of an industry. So I look at today as, you know, continuation of that opportunity at a time when things are very, very challenging. But, you know, certainly not more challenging than 1996 was.
Well, that is a great note to end on. So that's been a fantastic conversation and a very optimistic and inspiring one. Thank you very much, Don.
Yeah, thank you, Felicity.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.